Hello, this is Mark Shanton, welcoming you back after the summer break to Theatre Voice's regular critical roundup. Charles Spence of the Daily Telegraph, Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune, and David Benedict of Variety join me to talk first about five revivals in London, then in the second part we will turn our attention to five new plays. Let's begin with the return of the Ira Levin 1978 thriller Death Trap, which revolves around a writer of them finding new inspiration from the work of a young protege that may or may not involve his murder. Simon Russell Beale is the playwright and New York actor Jonathan Groff, best known for his appearances on TV's Glee, who first came to prominence in the original Broadway cast of Spring Awakening as the protege. The cast of Matthew Waters' production, now playing at the Noel Coward Theatre, also features Claire Skinner and Estelle Parsons. Matt, to begin with you, did you see the original in New York?
I did, actually, in 1978 at the Music Box Theatre, starring John Wood, and in fact I was working as a clerk one summer at Variety when Marion Seldes, the New York actress now turned legend, who was playing the wife, wanted to enter the Guinness Book of World Records as the longest serving person on Broadway never to miss a performance. And I was working at Variety that summer where she in fact achieved that record, and the producers rewarded her by putting her above the title, which was very sweet.
She did the entire run, didn't she?
She did the entire run and didn't miss a single show, playing Myra, the wife, who, without giving too much away, should we just say, has slightly less to do than some of the others. Anyway, I did see the original production. I don't remember it all that well. But what's interesting about it is that, of course, John Wood, great British classical actor at the time, resident in New York, who went on to play King Lear later in his career. And here in London, we've got a great British classical actor who lives in London, but who's been to New York quite a bit and who's going to go on to play King Lear. So in a sense, there's a kind of neat synchronicity about that. I like this production very much. I mean, it sort of does what it says it's going to do, and it does it with a certain amount of elan. And actually, Simon Russell Beale, without sort of overegging it, does suggest glints of darkness in what's essentially a comic thriller that I think works very well, and it gives you something more to think about and feast upon.
What do you think the appeal of the play is for actors like Simon Russell Beale, David? I mean, why would somebody of that substance do a play like this?
I question your remark, do a play like this. You know, that sort of implies that it's failed Ibsen. And in fact, one or two of the reviews got terribly snippy about it. Oh, well, you know, of course it really isn't a good enough play. And you go, it's not trying to have enormous amounts of depth. Actually, it's a really interesting character to play because he's someone that lies all night long. So as an actor, you have the rather interesting game of how much do you indicate to the audience that you're lying at any given point? How much do you have to appear to be telling the truth for the play to work? But there's a sort of thing around complicity that the audience really enjoys. What's so clever about the way this is written is that it's a series of cleverly sprung traps that the audience rather happily fall into because they think they're ahead of the game with, you know, who's murdering who and who's doing what and who's getting dragged into which bit of plot. And we think we're ahead of the game, and usually Ira Levin is at least one, if not two steps ahead of us, which is why there are great literal people leaping out of their seat moments. Yeah. You know, there are good screams in this. The West End used to be absolutely filled with things like that. They're now on television. You know, absolutely everything on TV that's a drama aspires to the condition of a police thriller. So that's why they died in the West End. It's much cheaper to watch them on your TV. But I think this is a very good example of the genre, and it's done exceedingly well.
It is famously a sort of dead genre. I mean, however, at the moment, we do have ghost stories causing people to jump out of their seats at the Duke of York's. And in fact, last night I was assaulted by the producer of The Mousetrap, who asked me when was the last time I saw it and why am I so rude about it, because I was rude about The Mousetrap in my Death Trap review. Charlie, have you seen the play before?
I hadn't, no. So I was really looking forward to this. It's the kind of sort of, light Shaftesbury Avenue fair, which I think is sort of terribly undervalued, and it is extremely well done. I have to say, I was slightly disappointed. I mean, it's often these things with expectations, and I thought this would be just my cup of tea. And the idea of Simon Russell Beale, you know, really great complex actor appearing in a comedy thriller was terribly tempting as well. I just felt it is so clever, it's almost too clever, and it seemed to me to have a sort of pleased with itself feeling. Not the production, the actual play. I think Levin is almost constantly visibly patting himself on the back with his own ingenuity. And I just, in the end, found it sterile. But I do think that Russell Beale did brilliantly with it, and the way he sort of, you know, nothing recedes like success is one of his lines, and the way he sort of played up on that line and developed it, and his relations with his wife. I mean, basically, Russell Beale, it seems to me, can do anything. It's extraordinary. I mean, there's almost no role he can't play, and he does do it very well. It is entertaining. I've also got a theory about this play and Sleuth, which I think it's not just the telly that killed them off. I think it's Sleuth and this play that did, which were brilliant in their plotting, but also sent the genre up so rotten and so well that no one can write a thriller now without it being a comedy, you know, a comedy thriller, very much with the comedy to the forefront, whereas in the old days they were thrillers with a bit of black comedy in them. And I think basically the genre is just one of those genres that has exhausted itself with these. These are sort of two decadent last flowerings of a genre that I suppose lasted for 50 years.
Indeed, it's a very meta thriller, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, in the way that actually a lot of musicals nowadays are meta musicals, and maybe musicals are writing themselves out of existence at the same time.
Well, that's what's interesting. Here's something written in 1978 that sort of anticipates a kind of self enclosed commentary that now you find all the time in the musical world, but 30 years ago you didn't find it in musicals, you found it in this particular
genre. Except you did in 42nd Street.
In 42nd Street, yes.
What about the rest of the cast? I mean, there's also Estelle Parsons, who's a wonderful Broadway actress who's in her 80s, playing
Helga Den Dorp, one of the great stupid names of our time.
Yes.
Played in the movie by Irene Wirth.
Right. And Jonathan Groff, of course. What did you...
I thought Jonathan Groff was terrific, actually. He has done plays in New York, quite a few of them, most of them off-Broadway and or in Central Park. And he's got stage presence, he's got a good voice, he has a real connection to Russell Beale, which I think is important, actually. And, I mean, memories can play tricks on one, of course. But I thought the central connection between Sidney Brewer, the Russell Beale character, and Clifford Anderson, the Groff character, was much stronger in this production than it was in 1978. And that may just be because what the connection describes is so much part of the landscape now that it can be fleshed out in a way that 30 years ago was much more coy. But I thought he was very good.
No, I think he was absolutely fine. I thought what the thing I thought was sad is, and I did think that the actress playing the psychic, whose name I've already forgotten,
Estelle Parsons, she's
a Broadway legend. I thought she was so over the top and embarrassing. But on the other hand, you always need a performance like that in thrillers with funny accents.
Exactly.
Funny,
yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, it's the funny accent role. She comes in with a cape, and we have to feel that she is ridiculous.
Yes.
And, you know, we can't give away as to why that. It's just important that she is absurd.
Yes.
I mean, there is a problem with the last scene. Again, don't wish to give too much away. But I understand that the director, Matthew Warchus, wanted to address that, and the rights holders wouldn't let the production tinker with anything, which I think is a shame, because sort of the air is let out of the balloon in the final scene, and it's handled very, very well in the movie. I saw the movie a long time ago, and watching the last scene, I realised that I remembered the last scene particularly well, because it's such an adroit solving of the puzzle. But
not here.
But not so much here.
No. I just a quick PS is I do think that Claire Skinner was completely wasted in it. Who is a very good actress, and she does
a very good
actress.
And also, she wasn't very good. She looked very uncomfortable in her.
I think she felt she was.
She looked very.
She gave the impression of an actress who thought she was slumming it for the money.
But she really did, whereas Russell Beale never does. But what's interesting is because she played Desdemona in the Sam Mendes Othello, in which Russell Beale was Iago. Mm. That, in a way, for this is only for theater people, but it sort of amplified the Iago-like sense that Russell Beale brings to his performance of Sidney, which is just lovely when you have the CV that Russell Beale has.
From one story of ambiguous sexuality to another, at the Old Vic, Noel Coward's comedy Design for Living, about a menage a trois based on his own friendship with celebrated theatre couple Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, with whom he originally starred in the play's 1934 Broadway premiere, has returned to London. This is the first time it's been seen here since the Donmar Warehouse revived it in 1994 with Rachel Weisz, Paul Rees and Clive Owen. This time, Anthony Page directs a cast that includes Lisa Dillon, Tom Burke and Andrew Scott. David, what did you make of this production?
Largely, I really, really liked it. It's got Les Brotherton's best set in a long time. It completely conveys the different worlds. The men, in particular, are outstandingly good. Angus Wright in the role of Ernest, the husband who's usually played as a complete stuffed shirt. You can anticipate his every line before he says it, because it's over, or rather undercast. Angus Wright, who's tall and very, very British, actually is an actor of great sensitivity, and he makes Ernest plausible, which makes the movement of the play, whereby eventually Gilda marries him, even though he's the dullest of the men, it gives that complete sense. The two men, particularly, well, Andrew Scott and Tom Burke, are fantastic. I had a big problem with Lisa Dillon, who, this may sound ridiculously picky and technical, but I think needs vocal work. She feels very effortful because she sort of keeps running out of breath and has to charge up every sentence that she utters, and it makes her look slightly out of control, and she should be the mesmerizing center of this play, and in fact she's working terribly hard, which slows the play down.
Interestingly, she's going straight on from this to another play at the Old Vic, Flea in Her Ear, so maybe Kevin Spacey will listen to this and pay attention. The problem I had with it, particularly, were the two boys, because I didn't find them sexy in the slightest. Now, I know that's possibly a personal thing, but I did say in the interval to Libby Purvis, the new theatre critic of the Times, that the only person whose clothes I wanted to rip off were Lisa Dillon's, and I'm gay. And she duly quoted that line in her review the next morning. Matt?
That's just because Ben Richards wasn't in it, Mark.
Exactly.
If he'd been in it, you would have had a very different reaction if he and Oliver Thornton had played these roles. I like this production a lot. I find this play endlessly fascinating because for all that it's on the front foot and very theatrical and concerned with performance and all of that, and is kind of meta in its own way, one of the characters, of course, being a playwright, which isn't unusual for Coward, I'm always struck by the degree to which it's a play largely about loneliness. And in fact, there's a kind of running thread throughout the text of people talking about being alone versus being lonely and how sometimes you're at your loneliest when you're not alone. And I thought this production caught that quite truthfully, again, without deconstructing it, without making a big meal out of it. The problem I had with Lisa Dillon is that she's not quite at the vortex of this triangle. She's described in the beginning, Gilda, as having a wild gleam in her eye, which I don't think she really has. But that aside, the men weren't perhaps the physical specimens, yes, Mark, that one might want or expect or demand. But Andrew Scott in particular, I thought there was something very febrile and dangerous and sort of reckless about his performance, which I have a feeling if Coward were alive, it would have blown him away.
Charlie is our token straight man in this gathering. Are you going to stand up for Lisa Dillon?
Not particularly.
poor Lisa Dillon.
I think I'm one of the very few who... I found this in production an intensely disappointing one. I remember the Donmar Warehouse one, which sort of really... wound up the Coward purists, yeah, and I remember Sheridan Morley absolutely going bonkers about it. But it absolutely reeked of sex and life and sort of daring, I felt. And I found this very sort of straight in the old-fashioned word production. I thought it plodded a lot. I thought the boys were miscast. I can't say whether they were sexy or not. They didn't do it for me. But they seem to me to lack the style and glamour that they were supposed to have, and particularly, is it Andrew Scott who was the very boyish one, the taller one? Andrew Scott. Well,
he's the one who plays the playwright.
Yeah, I found the playwright bland, and I found the artist sort of irritatingly sort of boy-like. Mm-hmm. I thought Andrew Scott was very bland. And as Gilda, I didn't feel she... Lisa Dillon cut the mustard at all, really. And I just didn't feel that... I didn't believe in the three of them. That's what it was. I didn't actually believe they were going through this and that it meant anything. And although I agree the designs are extremely handsome, it sort of struck me as that sort of dead masterpiece theatre because of them. I much preferred Sean Mathias's production. And I don't normally like his work, but I thought it brought something really fresh and raw out of it. I also saw a production by Peter Hall about 3 years ago with Janie D in it, which really brought a warmth to it, which is something I'd never thought of before. But I absolutely agree. But for me, the performance by far the best performance was Angus Wright as the stuffy husband, which was masterly, and also the only bit that moved me.
And of course he's so tall, and they keep calling him Little Ernest, and yes. it makes them look slightly yes. foolish yeah. that they can't actually look at him and see that he towers over them. He's wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
I'm going to come back in this production's defence. I fairly loathed the Sean Mathias production because it was so busy pointing out what the play should rather subtly point out. You know, at the end of every act. Literally the nets descended, these black gauzes came across, and then we had a sex scene going behind them, just to point out, in case you hadn't noticed in the preceding scene, oh my God, the boys are also gay, oh my goodness me, they're tearing their clothes off. And yes, Rupert Graves was handsome, as was Clive Owen.
That was the recast. Rupert Graves and Marcus D'Amico did the West End, and Paul Rees and Clive Owen did the Don.
Well remembered.
But I just felt that there was that what this had was real subtext. It didn't do that very contemporary confusion of going, oh look, we'll play the subtext as the text. This gave different levels, and that there was much more going on, and that there was much more subtlety. And you know, maybe I saw a different performance. I went a week after press night, where they're not tense, and all those relationships really were being played. There was also very nice character work elsewhere. Nancy Crane was terrific as Grace Torrance, the woman who's trying to buy art and is impossibly grand and rather enjoys the company of these two young men that turn up in the third act with their malice aforethought.
And a very wonderful maid.
Yes,
the maid is wonderful, Maggie McCarthy. I also just want to champion slightly more the play itself, because not only, I think, is it a sort of illuminating commentary on loneliness and how we disguise that in the cloaks that we don in order to get on with life and make life a performance, but it's also a fantastic commentary on celebrity. And there's a wonderful scene, I think, in the second act where Leo is visited by a journalist and a photographer. And I thought Andrew Scott fielded that so beautifully in terms of wanting the attention, which he was simultaneously loathing. And of course, that is rewritten now on a daily basis in the internet age.
And whenever we go to interview somebody.
Yes.
Also, I do think that that it's well cast in the sense that you usually get the woman and then two louche people, one of whom is a playwright and one of whom is a painter, and you can't tell the difference between the two because they're too busy playing louche. And actually, there's something very epicene about Andrew Scott, who I think is actually one of the best actors in the country. And Tom Burke is very antithetical to that, and he's rather solid in this.
He looks like a boxer.
And you could see, therefore, sort of all the different attractions between the three of them and the different personalities that Gilda is drawn to. I thought it was very effective.
Matt, you kept mentioning the loneliness, because that's another theme of Crap's Last Tape, Samuel Beckett's short play about an old man reviewing his life by way of listening to tapes that his younger self once made. It was last seen in London when Harold Pinter played at the Royal Court in his final stage acting appearance in 2006. Now Michael Gambon, who's 69, returns to the West End to play it at the Duchess after withdrawing last year from the premiere of The Habit of Art at the National. It's great to have Michael Gambon back, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is. And as you say, he's 69, which is the same age as Crap in the play, so that's interesting. This is probably the fourth or fifth version of this I've seen, and I guess it's true of critics with whatever the material, that at certain points you see something which is bound to be definitive and everything else is a bit of a falling away, and I'm afraid that's what I felt about this when I saw it with Pinter, that there was something about watching Pinter, directed by Ian Rickson, do this play at the theater, at the Royal Court Theater upstairs, which was a facing down of one's own mortality like I've almost never seen anywhere else and don't expect to see much again. And Gambon, whether or not he's had poor health of late, that's been much debated in the press, it didn't quite have the shock to the solar plexus that it had with Pinter. Nice though it was to see Gambon, and I found it sort of oddly fussy. It seemed kind of over-embellished, and gags were repeated, and it seemed, even though it's a short play, it seemed too long. There were great moments, wonderful moments, and he has this fantastic ravine-like lined face, which is great for Beckett, of course, but it didn't knock me out.
Pinter, of course, played it very static because he was very ill. And he was,
and indeed in a wheelchair.
Whereas this one's a much more physical performance, isn't it, Charlie?
Yeah, I think... I agree. That Pinter play was like a self-portrait of extraordinary depth, and also that Pinter had always admired Beckett so much, and it was kind of like, it's something we'll never see again. It was unique. and actually took considerable liberties with the play because there were, you know, because he couldn't do the bananas and stuff like that. I thought this was very good. I mean, I don't think it. I thought it. But because after the Pinter, you couldn't quite forget it was a performance, whereas Pinter seemed to be, the enigmatic Pinter seemed to be laying himself bare for the first, you know, absolutely bare before his audience. I mean, perhaps it's a bit sentimental to see it like that, but that's how it felt. I just can't see enough of this play. I just think it is just such a fantastic play, not a word wasted. I think it's the most moving of all Beckett's plays, and also in a way, the most consolatory, in that it acknowledges love so beautifully in that repeated passage. And I thought that that Gambon was particularly good at those at the poetry of it, and the bit about going out with the bitch in the fields. I just can't bring myself to criticise this play, and I was, as always, transfixed and moved. And there were some very nice touches. I thought it was like, at the start, it was like you'd arrived too late, because it looked as though he was dead before he'd started. And I loved the way he ran his fingernails down that desk, and it sounded like the rattling of bones. And I thought his face, it put me in mind of a sort of Rembrandt's self-portraits, that sort of exhausted honesty of the late Rembrandt. So I did like it very much, not quite in the same class as Pinter. And also for me, not quite in the same class as Max Wall, who did it absolutely wonderfully. It didn't quite feel as though Gambon had quite got there himself, which is where I think both Pinter and Max Wall were by
that's,
the time they
that's
played
That's, I
it.
Think, the thing, much as I admired it, which
it
I
was
did,
a performance,
I felt like he was slightly annotating it, whereas with Pinter you felt absolutely he was on the inside, particularly the bit at the end about the fire in one's belly and the peace or not that this speaker has to make with that. But I'm glad you mentioned the fingernails, because there's a sort of separate fascination which the late Mel Gussow once wrote about apropos of Gambon, having to do with his hands, because he's got these enormous hands with these long spidery fingers, and he sort of turns those into a play within the play at the very beginning, when he's kind of reaching around his head and his fingers seem to go on forever. And you feel as if he's kind of encaging himself. It's really extraordinary. And he does do lovely things. I mean, there's a bit where he gets the word spool, and he just sort of protracts it with this almost sort of sexual caress. So I hope it's not the last thing he ever does on stage, but who's to say?
And it's also certainly very bold to have it in the West End at all. I mean, a 50-minute play, and he's doing it twice nightly, like the old variety days. But fascinating.
I hope most audiences are better than the opening night audience, which was ghastly. And it's interesting, because there's a line in the play that about the extraordinary silence this evening that crap refers to, and you thought, not with that audience.
No, mobile phones, coughing.
I got terrible mobile phone problems at one performance.
Yes. Stephen Sondheim's 1994 chamber musical Passion, first seen in the West End in a production that starred Michael Ball and Maria Friedman at the Queen's Theatre, has now returned to London as the centrepiece of the Donmar's Sondheim at 80 Festival that marks both the composer's 80th birthday and his long association with the Covent Garden Theatre. Charlie, you saw this originally in New York in 1994, didn't like it much then, but this time round I saw your review, acclaimed it a masterpiece.
Yeah, I was really bowled over by it. It was, as you know, I'm not a total Sondheim nut, like I expect most of the people in this room, and I do find that I'm a sort of musical comedy guy, I think, and I do find him too subtle at times and too picky in a way. But and when I saw this in New York, I thought it was like a sort of career suicide note. It was in previews when I saw it, fairly early previews, and it was so kind of self-regarding and slow. But this production had such intensity, and Elena Roger was so moving. And it's basically, it's just a 90-minute play about unconditional love with some of the most thrilling music Sondheim's ever written, it seems to me. And I loved the mixture of these sort of really desperate ballads and dreamy romances and the constant use of snare drums through it to get the military. I don't think there'll ever be a better production of it. I mean, it just absolutely grips from start to finish, and I was just laid waste by it, really.
Indeed, the score is like one long rhapsody, isn't it? In fact, originally, the numbers didn't have names. It was all written as a through...
Well, the names now aren't... If you look at them, they don't print them in the programme, and if you look at them online, they're all sort of soliloquy number one, soliloquy number two.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous score, and I think the sublimely performed by this cast. I mean, all through the ranks. This new boy, David Thaxton, who straight out of Les Miserables, is quite extraordinary as Georgie.
I mean, I think that
Jamie Lloyd has wanted to do this for about 6 years, and it really shows. It's about 20 minutes shorter than the Broadway original, partly because he's cut some of the transitions, and he's cut a long speech by the Doctor towards the end, and he's just tightened it and allowed the thing to move into that one rhapsodic flow. Jeremy Sams put an interval into the original London production so that all the people that really disliked it, all the Michael Ball fans, could leave. But actually restoring its original flow really helps the piece. But the rest of the time, people are just acting faster. The original production was terrifyingly literal, really, really obvious. There wasn't a shred of subtext. There wasn't a single moment of levity. You know, there are not many, but there are laughs in this production. You know, the absurdity of some of the situation is recognised rather than given po-faced seriousness. And it's always thought to be a show about the Elena Roger character. It's thought to be about Fosca. It's not. It's about the man. It's about the man who eventually discovers that he can fall in love with somebody that he thought he wasn't going to, that he was turned off by. And by making him young, David Paxton, very inexperienced, by making him young, the fact that he's so callow makes complete sense. He can also act, which Jerry Shea in the original could not do, and Michael Ball is not an actor either. So you see things through his eyes, so the show is completely rebalanced, as opposed to big star and somebody else.
Yes.
It becomes about the man with the two women on either side. Scarlett Stravinger also gives much more depth to the other female character.
What?
So it feels like a new show.
The interesting thing is, there's one thing about it which sort of, I think, is fascinating, because it realises this really big question about love, really, is can you love, as he almost does, as an act of will? It's a very interesting question. Can you force yourself to fall in love with someone because they need your love so much? Well, can you think of any other work that actually addresses that question? Because I can't. I'm not sure he's right to say that it can, but it's a fascinating, it's a unique piece of subject matter.
And I also think it's very interesting that the role of Clara, which I, in previous productions, always thought was a kind of supporting, subsidiary role, and not important at all, actually is a much larger part than I realised, thanks to Scarlett Stralin, who brings this kind of luminous quality to
it. Oh, she's so sexy. I say, as the token straight, I mean, she is absolutely gorgeous, which makes it so much more interesting that he goes for Elena Roger. Though, of course, she's not as ugly as they made her in the last one, is she?
She's not really ugly at all.
She's ill
and ailing and it's odd. And
odd
is different from ugly. That sounds like a line from Into the Woods. It's different from nice. Sorry, Steve. But particularly in the production here on the West End with Maria Friedman, who won an Olivier for her performance, but she played Fosca like a sort of witch-like grotesque. And it wasn't recognizable in sort of any context, and it seemed like something out of a Hammer horror film, accomplished though it was vocally. I think this production, quite frankly, is beyond praise, and I think it's also one of the very best things that Donmar's ever done, which is saying a lot. I mean, I almost burst into tears when I walked into the auditorium and saw Christopher Orme's surpassingly beautiful design, which is like being absorbed into an Italian fresco. It is beyond gorgeous.
It's provincial. It just gets
it's
provincialist.
It's
so
gorgeous. And David Thaxton's performance, I think, is really beyond praise as well, in the journey that he takes you on, so that at the end, when there's this whole bit about my love will live in you, my love will live in you, previously you look at George and you think, oh, well, what does that mean? With David Thaxton, you look at him and he has been somehow hollowed out. He's shaking. He's not well, quote unquote. And weirdly, Fosca, by that point, without giving too much away, is at her most erect. She's at her most serene. Her hair is down. She seems to have bequeathed to him something, call it love or call it whatever, but it's very dangerous. And I think in a way, it gives this musical almost the quality of something like the metaphysical poets, without being too grand about it. I think it's really very profound.
It just gains immeasurably, as many shows do, from being on that scale. The problem with Passion originally is that there really isn't a theatre in New York that could take this show. It was put onto the stage of the Plymouth, which is one of the smaller Broadway houses, but actually it's still a Broadway house. It was too big. You want the concentration, you want to be in the room with these people, and actually not only are we able to listen to them,
but they are so obviously all listening to each other, which sounds like a truism, but many a show that we could all point to in the West End where no one's listening to anybody else, and they're all anticipating each other's lines. And this, everybody is hanging upon each other's words. And there's just something about that intimacy which also underlines what's very interesting about some of the writing of the show musically, which is that it shifts almost imperceptibly from speech into song and out again. And that really works when you don't have to play it big to an 800-seat house, when you can almost whisper stuff and you can move that easily between the forms, then it also aids that fantastic sense of flow which the piece needs.
Actually, I don't think I've ever seen a show where the movement between dialogue and song was so beautifully done. It felt like the most natural thing in the world.
And that's a single applause break as well, yeah. And that felt also completely
natural. Well, it was so interesting seeing it back-to-back with Krapp's Last Tape, just in terms of audience, because at Krapp's Last Tape we had the restless audience to which we've referred. The press night of this, almost from the beginning, at one point I looked around because you could hardly hear people breathing. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of held silence, which was quite thrilling. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely thrilling to be a part of.
We should not forget to point out that actually, you know, this is a really, really major achievement by Jamie Lloyd. I mean, I think this is, you know, we're all in agreement, this has never been given a better production. It's unlikely to see one. You know, this is a very, very difficult show to pull off. And what's so beautiful about it, you know, there's very nice movement by Scott Ambler, but you know, it is, the direction is like Invisible Mending. It's so subtle, but actually he's doing an awful lot.
Well, he must be, because it's always been disliked so much and so intensely.
Well, but there's so many quiet revelations in addition to large revelations. For instance, near the end, and it's crucial to the transformation of Giorgio as a character, when he's having the, you know, throughout he's having these protestations of affection for Clara, what's her name again?
Scarlet Strahlan.
So, protestations of affection for Clara, the Scarlet Strahlan character. And right near the end, when he delivers one of them, all of a sudden he sounds eerily flat and affectless. And you think, he's saying it, but there's nothing beneath it. And you think, it's all changing. And it's beautifully done, very subtle. The chorus of military men seemed to become, after a while, like a kind of collective almost out of Sweeney Todd, or Peter Grimes, this sort of malevolent male force that, of course, Giorgio doesn't blend into, and that makes sense when Fosca and he have the thing about drums and music, and that's very, very telling. It just works on multiple levels.
Yeah, then my last point would be that actually one of the things that Jamie Lloyd has done is to transform the chorus. There are other female characters in the original score. They've gone. The chorus, i.e. the soldiers, become a real chorus. They play everything in a very affectless way.
Yeah.
When necessary, one of them plays Fosca's mother in a flashback sequence. It's not underlined, it's just there. So instead of going, oh God, why have we got another chorus from these silly soldiers so that a set can be moved? Those have all gone, and they become a kind of a vocal, this is what you need in order to get us to the next scene. It's very, very clean, very neat, and thus it allows all the emotion of the piece to pour forth.
And actually it is like a Greek chorus, and it is like a classical tragedy in a musical, isn't it, really? And it's got that feeling of inevitability about it, and complete structure, and built so soundly.
And it's perfectly married to the space, absolutely perfectly. Of the five or six Sondheim musicals that Omar has done, this of all of them, I think, is most intimately wedded to that
space.
It'd
be interesting to see if they do transfer it. I can't imagine where it will go.
It's a shame they can't run it on there.
Finally, in this section, Les Miserables, or Les Mis, as it's now universally known, is currently celebrating the 25th year of its original premiere at the Barbican Theatre, before transferring to the West End's Queen's Theatre and seemingly global domination, in which has been seen by over 55 million people in 42 countries so far. Now, to mark the anniversary, producer Cameron McIntosh has had it entirely restaged for a new touring production that he has also brought back to the Barbican for a short season, as well as presenting a one-off concert at the O2 Arena. David, you can take the RSC out of the Barbican, but can you take the RSC out of Les Miserables?
Well, difficult to say. Is that, you know, this is not an RSC show anymore. Clearly, it's a Cameron McIntosh show in every sense. I saw Les Mis about 4 years ago at the Queen's, and was sort of dismayed by how flat it was, and how inert the storytelling was, and how dated it all looked.
So I have no problem with the idea that this show could be reinvigorated 25 years on. And whilst the two young directors that have been brought in, interestingly, Jamie Lloyd was originally going to do this and had to pull out. So we end up with two people who clearly aren't really directors. And they have no idea how to get subtlety out of any of the performers.
Also, they've had a very long association with the show. Both of them were in the show once. And indeed, I think that's probably the gripe that Trevor Nunn and John Caird have, is that they've kind of been, their best bits have been borrowed. And indeed, John Napier's a design assistant on the show is now the designer of this production.
Well, John Napier's design assistant may well be the designer on the show, but it's got a completely different look and feel because it's got these absolutely exquisite Victor Hugo paintings used as backdrops. It's one of the best uses of projection I've seen in a very long time. Because normally the problem when you have projections is, because they have to be lit, you end up with unbelievably flat light everywhere else on the stage. These backdrops, which are suggestive rather than literal, there's sort of, you know, it's, you never get an actual townscape. You get, it looks like, almost like a Utrillo drawing of a town.
Or now Whistler Nocturne.
Exactly,
is what they're
exactly.
Like.
And so, you know, they're suggestive rather than literal. And they don't swamp the stage with light. So actually you get some of the best lighting I've ever seen in the theatre, either guiding you through the transitions or setting scenes. I mean, there's a scene of an outdoor tavern that's come straight out of a Jan Steen painting from you know, a Dutch master. It's incredibly beautiful to look at. It's so driven and so pushed. There are times when you wish the show could just breathe a little, but actually it works. I'm not fond of Les Mis, but if you are, I think this is a very fine production.
And indeed, there are some great performances in it. I mean, John Owen Jones, who's done Les Mis in London and on Broadway, and is now doing this yet again, is after Colm Wilkinson, he's kind of fairly definitive as a Valjean.
Yeah, he is. He's very moving, I thought. And the thing is about Les Mis, it's hard to love it because there's a sort of ruthless efficiency about it. But at the same time, it does the trick. I don't think it's great art, but there's something about it, and when they're all in full song, and I found that this smaller, more compressed, and as David says, there's wonderful backdrops, and I was absolutely hooked. I always have the same experience. I've seen it about 4 or 5 times now. I always find, while I'm watching it, I'm absolutely driven and hooked on it, and at the end, it somehow doesn't stay with you. And I think, a bit almost like the sort of early Disney films, which, you terrified me as a kid, and then afterwards the fear when. It's not great art, but there's no doubt it's really great entertainment. And I think, actually, this production, by taking a bit of time out of it, which is always, it's always been too long, and it's still actually slightly too long, I think. But it does, for the most part, it absolutely holds you. And it's also had the wonderful effect of making Trevor Nunn go into one of his great self-blustering outrages of self-pity. And we seek a meeting, we are not informed. And I find the whole thing absolutely comic joy, really. So... So in every way, this was a good event. What's surprising is that this is it. It's finished. It finishes at the Barbican at the end of this week, and it's not going out on the road anymore.
It's going internationally. It's going international.
All right.
Yeah, it's got a 3-year tour of America, and it's got other international rollouts as well. I mean, it's a big deal.
And my strong suspicion is that they'll probably close the one at the Queen's and move this one in, but that's not been officially announced.
Don't
by
tell
any
that
means.
To Trevor. Trevor got berserk.
On that note, thank you, Matt, David, and Charlie.
Thank you.